all three right-wing justices on the bench a few years after stonewalling President Obama's Supreme Court justice pick, Merrick Garland. It's absolutely amazing what happened, saying when Scalia died. I want to play a clip of McConnell himself talking about why Merrick Garland would not be able to have a hearing before the election the following November.
It's been more than 80 years since a Supreme Court vacancy arose and was filled in a presidential election year. And that, Mr. President, was when the Senate majority and the president were from the same political party. The same political party. It's been 80 years. Since we have divided government today, it means we have to look back almost 130 years to the last time a nominee was confirmed in similar circumstances. That's back when politicians like mugwumps were debating policies like free silver, and a guy named Grover ran the country. Think about that. As senators, it leaves us with a choice. Will we allow the people to continue deciding who will nominate the next justice, or will we empower a lame duck president to make that decision on his way out the door instead?
So that was 2016. Meanwhile, September 2020, Senate Democrats slammed Senate Majority Leader McConnell for rushing to fill Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's seat so close to the November election, holding hearings on the nomination of the conservative federal judge Amy Coney Barrett. When early voting had already begun in some states, she was confirmed a week before Biden's election. Senator Merkley, your assessment of McConnell's tenure?
Yes, back in the mid-1990s, when Gingrich was shifting strategy on the House side, and that shift in strategy was to say, rather than cooperate with the majority to get some things into bills, we'll basically obstruct them as much as we can and then argue that their failures mean they should be replaced. And it proved to be an effective strategy. McConnell said Gingrich gives obstruction a good name. But in the Senate, he had tools Gingrich could never have dreamed of. He had the nomination process, which every objection to closing debate means a nomination could take a week, so he could really slow things down. And then he had the 60-vote requirement for closing debate. And if you flip the math, it means that in the minority, with 41 votes, you can paralyze the Senate on policy bills. And he used that in an aggressive strategy, and he used it on nominations, and he really brought obstruction to be the premier tool of the minority, arguing the more you obstruct, the more you make the case for the majority to be replaced by the minority. I really thought when I first heard this was just so absurd, and the American people would see it and understand it and reject it and penalize the minority for using obstruction in this fashion. But I was wrong. It turned out to be an incredibly effective strategy because the American people hold the majority accountable. They're like, if you've got a problem with getting things done, solve that problem. You are in charge. And so his legacy has been one of obstruction. And it has been one in which he has used the most convenient argument of the moment in order to make power moves on behalf of the Republican Party, to make the first time in U.S. history that the Senate didn't debate a nominee, the very first time. I called it the stolen seat. And when Obama nominated near the end of his term, and then proceed to change the rules for the Supreme Court, and in exact contravention of the argument he'd made just prior. So it was the argument of the moment, no consistency except the strategy of obstruction of Democrats and power moves for Republicans. And for the power moves, I'm sure much of the Republican Party appreciates him for the Supreme Court does, but it has done incredible damage to the institution of the Senate and incredible damage to the institution of the Supreme Court.
And are you concerned that the person who replaces him will be even more extreme? Word is it's going to be one of the three Johns who always stand behind him, Senators John Thune of South Dakota, John Cornyn of Texas, and John Barrasso, perhaps the most MAGA, of Wyoming.
There's a lot of things to worry about, but some things are completely out of my control, so I'll just wait and see what happens. And that certainly is the case in the selection of the Republican leader.
We're speaking with Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley, who's authored a new book with his chief of staff titled Filibustered, How to Fix the Broken Senate and Save America. This is Senator Merkley holding a filibuster-like session overnight back in 2017, speaking for more than 15 hours in protest of the Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch's nomination.
And to confirm anyone but Merrick Garland to this seat confirms the Senate as the thief who took the seat for the first time in U.S. history and transported to another president in an effort to pack the court.
So, Senator Merkley, if you could talk about your book just out last month.
Yes. Well, that situation that night, what I knew was coming was that at the very moment that the majority leader McConnell, proceeded to put the nomination on the floor for Gorsuch, he also filed to close debate. And so there wasn't a long obstruction of any kind. There was zero obstruction. But he wanted to make sure he did this as quickly as possible, that is to install Gorsuch, in order to have the public pay as little attention as possible. He knew it was controversial. He wanted to get it over with, and so he minimized the debate in a fashion we've never seen before, and also did that to change the rules from a supermajority to close debate to a simple majority. Democrats had changed the rules after massive obstruction by McConnell on lower courts, but we'd said to the Supreme Court has to retain the integrity and legitimacy necessary to play its role in the balance of powers and the separation of powers in our government, and that therefore we should leave that as a supermajority requirement. McConnell, in this power move, said, well, you know what? We're going to get those judges in no matter how extreme they are, no matter how flawed they are, because they are going to rule in fashion that is like legislating for the far right. And that's what we have now, a deeply damaged court operating as really a legislature for the far right.
So, Senator, I know you have to go, but we want to ask about that subtitle, which is key, How to Fix the Broken Senate and Save America.
Yes. Well, right now we are completely paralyzed by the cloture motion designed to be used once a decade. It's used once or twice a day, and it takes a week. It's just completely paralyzed the place. We have, instead of a voice for the minority and an incentive to compromise, we have a veto by the minority without an incentive to compromise. And that means the cycle of government is broken. The American people believe that government is supposed to be you elect people, and if you get a majority, then they can implement that vision. But if you can't implement that vision because there's a minority veto, then that just produces cynicism and frustration, which is exactly what we see today. The founders had seen this with the Confederation Congress, which required a supermajority. They said, whatever you do, never replicate this. This will be a formula for tedious situations and contemptible compromises of the common good. But we have done exactly what the founders said not to do, flipped democracy on the head, given the minority the power to choose the path, and broken the cycle in which government can function. That is why we have to reform the filibuster, go from this current 41-vote paralysis to a talking filibuster where there's an incentive for compromise and where the debate is held before the American people, and there's an eventual pathway to get to a majority vote.
Senator Jeff Merkley, we want to thank you so much for being with us, co-author of the new book, Filibustered, How to Fix the Broken Senate and Save America. Senator Merkley traveled to the Rafah crossing back in January. Now in November, has become only the second senator to call for a ceasefire in Gaza. When we come back, we're going to speak to one of his constituents. That's right. We're going to speak to another Oregonian who's teaching at the University of Oregon in Eugene. He's a UN special rapporteur on the right to food, Michael Fakhri. Stay with us.
Tell me another story with a happy ending. Got my feet so weird. my heart need mending.
I don't know what the weather will be, Laura Mavula with the Metropole Orchestra. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Palestinians waiting for humanitarian aid in Gaza are coming under fire from Israeli forces in Gaza as acute hunger and severe malnutrition are spreading. In the latest attack earlier today, over 100 Palestinians were killed and more than 700 wounded in Gaza City when they came under fire from Israeli tanks and drones. Over 500,000 people in Gaza are on the cusp of starvation, while virtually the entire population of 2.3 million people is in desperate need of food as a result of the continued Israeli bombardment, ground attacks, and ongoing siege. According to the United Nations, the amount of aid reaching the Palestinian territory dropped by 50% in February compared to the previous month. This is Ramesh Rajasingham, Coordination Director of the UN's Humanitarian Office, speaking at the Security Council on Wednesday.
In December, it was projected that the entire population of 2.2 million people in Gaza would face high levels of acute food insecurity by February 2024. The highest share of people facing this level of food insecurity ever recorded worldwide. And here we are at the end of February with at least 576,000 people in Gaza, one quarter of the population, one step away from famine.
The UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, Michael Fakhri, says Israel's intentionally starving Palestinians and should be held accountable for war crimes. Michael Fakhri joins us now from Eugene, Oregon. He's a professor of law at the University of Oregon. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Michael Fakhri. Why don't you lay out what you understand is happening and what is international law around the right to food?
Yes, thank you, Amy. Every single person in Gaza is hungry right now. A quarter of the population, so that's 500,000 people, are starving, and famine is imminent. We've never seen an entire population, 2.2 million people, made to go hungry this quickly and this completely. And people's health is rapidly declining. What's really concerning now is we're starting to hear reports of children dying from dehydration, malnutrition, and starvation. We've never seen children pushed into malnutrition so quickly. In the almost 5 months of war, there have been more children, more journalists, more medical personnel, more UN staff killed more than anywhere else in the world in any conflict. In early October, when this war began, myself, amongst other independent UN human rights experts, immediately called for a warning of a risk of genocide, asking that there be an immediate ceasefire to prevent genocide. Unfortunately, what's happened is the war has gotten worse. Israel's attacks against civilians has continued and expanded. And I think it's safe to say this is a genocide. And now we're in the situation where we're seeing starvation and we're seeing the denial of humanitarian aid and the destruction of the food system itself in Gaza.
And Michael, if you could respond to the news from earlier today, authorities in Gaza saying Israeli forces committed a massacre in Gaza City, killing at least 104 Palestinians as they waited for food aid. Gaza's health ministry says over 760 people were wounded in what Hamas called an unprecedented war crime. According to eyewitnesses, Israeli forces opened fire on the crowd who'd gathered around humanitarian aid trucks. So if you could respond to that and, you know, what that means in terms of the very little food aid getting in, and people trying to get it. And then this is what happens.
Yes, this isn't so. Unfortunately, this isn't the first time people have been shot at by Israeli forces while trying to get access to aid. So this most recent story has been the most tragic in terms of the number of dead and the number of wounded. But there have been repeated reports of Israeli forces shooting at Palestinian civilians who are waiting to receive aid. We've also heard reports of Israel bombarding convoys of aid trucks, even after those routes are coordinated with Israeli forces. So Israeli forces know exactly where those convoys are, and nevertheless, they are shooting at them. Moreover, there's been planned convoys that have been attempted to be sent to northern Gaza, and the last convoy that was sent, that Israel allowed to reach northern Gaza, was January 23rd. So not only is Israel shooting at people getting aid, bombarding trucks en route, they're denying convoys from reaching the north, and they're making it very difficult for trucks to cross the borders, as we heard from Senator Merkley, whether it's through Rafah crossing the border with Egypt, or where most aid is coming through is the Kerem Shalom crossing, which is through Israel.
So, Michael Fakhry, you're really explaining a dire situation. I mean, looking on film at people in Gaza, the sunken eyes, how skinny their bodies are. We have reports. Al Jazeera was just doing a report from one of the hospitals in northern Gaza. It was Kamal Adwan Hospital, where they said infants are in the hospital. They no longer have parents. Usually at the hospital, there's a can of milk for every infant. Here, there isn't a can for the entire ward. What does it mean to be the UN Special Rapporteur on the right to food? What kind of power do you have? What kind of reports do you do?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I'm running out of words to be able to describe the horror of what's happening and how vile the actions have been by Israel against the Palestinian civilians. My job is to be, I'm an independent expert. I'm given authority by the Human Rights Council of the United Nations. This is a volunteer position. My job is to be the eyes, ears, and sometimes good conscience for the UN system on all matters regarding hunger, malnutrition, and famine from a human rights perspective. So what I do is I present reports to the Human Rights Council and to the General Assembly. I decide what's on the agenda when I present to them. I decide what is the right to food agenda when presenting to the Human Rights Council and the General Assembly. So my most recent report when I go to the General to the Human Rights Council next week will be on the role of small-scale fishers. What I will be doing now between now and then the General Assembly in October is my next report will be on starvation with an emphasis on Gaza, because unfortunately we're seeing a rise in conflict all over the world. Conflict is the main source of hunger in the world. And also for that report to create a record of what's going on in Gaza, because we're seeing starvation we're at the brink of famine. And what's the thing to remember about starvation and famine, it's always, always human made. It's always the result of political choices. Never has there been a famine in modern history that was not because people with power made very specific choices and chose and decided to punish civilians. And what we're seeing in Gaza is no different than that historical record.
Michael Fakhry, could you talk about the International Court of Justice ordering provisional measures and what's come of that? To what extent did Israel comply with those provisional measures?
Yeah, on January 26th, the International Court of Justice stated in its provisional measures, and here I'm going to quote verbatim, that the state of Israel must take immediate and effective measures to enable the provision of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance to address the adverse conditions of life faced by the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. What the court also did is it considered the catastrophic humanitarian situation, these are their words, in the Gaza Strip is, quote, at a serious risk of deteriorating. That's the International Court of Justice in late January. What happened? Instead, Israel did not comply with the court. In fact, it tried to undermine the court's authority. And what they did, in fact, is they've been restricting and denying the delivery of humanitarian aid to people in Gaza. And around that same time in late January, Israel denied there was even a humanitarian crisis or starvation. And so what we saw instead of compliance with the International Court of Justice is a reduction of humanitarian aid by 50%. And so to put it in perspective, before the war began, approximately 500 trucks used to enter Gaza a day. Now, if we're lucky, the average is about 100, but it's that's an average amount. The other thing to remember, even before all of this happened, is Israel had a lot of control over the entry of food into Gaza through a 17-year blockade. Because the question we have to ask, how was Israel able to make 2.2 million people go so hungry so quickly and completely? They were already keeping people on the brink of hunger through the 17-year blockade, making it very difficult for fishers to access the sea. And 50% of people in Gaza before the war were already food insecure. 80% relied on humanitarian aid. So it's so clear that not only is Israel not complying with the International Court of Justice, but I would add now that Israel is using humanitarian aid as a bargaining chip. So not only is it breaching international law and the order of the International Court of Justice, it's clear now because what we saw on Tuesday, this is February 27th, this Tuesday, Israel and Hamas began negotiating for a potential 40-day truce. And it's important to note, what has Israel offered in the negotiations? They've offered humanitarian relief to Palestinians in Gaza. So what Israel is offering, they want concessions from Hamas, they're offering things like a commitment to bring in 500 trucks per day of humanitarian aid. Israel is potentially committing to providing 200,000 tents and 60,000 caravans, and they're offering to rehabilitate hospitals and bakeries and to allow for the necessary equipment to enter. This is the bare minimum. What they're offering as a political negotiation is the basic bare minimum as a legal obligation in terms of international humanitarian law, as a legal obligation to comply with the International Court of Justice, as a legal obligation to meet human rights law. But again, this is the bare minimum. And they've been withholding this. They've been withholding this. And now that we see the negotiations for a truce, we see how Israel is using it as a bargaining chip to offer something as if it's a political choice and not a legal, and I would add, a moral obligation.
Is Israel committing a war crime, Michael Fakhry?
Undoubtedly. Undoubtedly, they are committing war crimes. But let me add, a war crime, what's interesting about war crimes is we can only hold individuals accountable for war crimes. This is something I think more existential. This is why we are saying, we being the dozens of independent UN human rights experts are saying this is genocide. This is why the International Court of Justice is saying there's a plausible case for genocide from their perspective. What we mean by saying this is genocide means that Palestinian people, the people, are being targeted simply because they are Palestinian. Simply because of who they are. This is what makes it genocide. What's important about framing it genocide is, of course, the remedy that that is available. Genocide means the state of Israel itself is culpable. That because if to go back to starvation, this is a systemic denial of humanitarian aid. This is a political choice to use the denial of humanitarian aid and starving of people as a political bargaining chip. This means that the entire state of Israel is culpable, but that also means that the remedy is not just throw this individual or that individual in jail, maybe in some few years in the future. What the remedy is for genocide is fully recognizing the right of the Palestinian people for self-determination. This is why it's important to understand this as a genocide.
Let's move from Gaza to the West Bank. Can you talk about the attacks on farmers on the West Bank? What is happening on the ground? Who is responsible, Michael Fakhry?
Yeah. So what's also interesting is that when this particular war started in Gaza, immediately we saw an escalation of violence by Israeli settlers against Palestinians and specifically against Palestinian farmers. And we saw increased violence by Israeli forces against Palestinians in the West Bank. And so what's happened now is that the harvest season for olives has passed and farmers were not able to harvest olives. This has several implications. So there's a record number of violence we're seeing in the West Bank, more than ever in recent times. And attacking the olive trees and olive harvest is not just about olives, which are important for nutrition and for food and for making sure that the land remains fruitful in the future. The olive tree is central to Palestinian identity. It reflects and is a core aspect of the Palestinian people's relationship to the land, to traditions, to their ancestors, and to the future. And so to attack and undermine and eliminate some olive trees is, again, attack against the Palestinian people at their core. So what we're seeing, again, this is why we're so concerned that this is not just about a war in Gaza. This is escalated violence against Palestinian people. And you can track this when you follow food, when you follow the relation of agriculture, when you look at fishers in Gaza. And if I might turn also to how the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, has been threatened by the lack of funding. So because of unfounded claims by Israel, claiming that at first they said 12, and now the number's down to 9 employees out of 30,000 employees, major donors to UNRWA have decided to end funding. This includes the United States, Germany, Canada, Japan, amongst many others. This punishes all Palestinian refugees across the board, not just in Gaza, but in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, but also in Lebanon, in Syria, and Jordan. So time and time again, what we are seeing is this increased rate of violence against all Palestinian people simply because of who they are.
And Michael Fakhri, let's just end with the global hunger crisis, which the World Food Program has noted is of unprecedented proportions. In just 2 years, the number of people facing or at risk of acute food insecurity increased from 135 million before the pandemic to 345 million now.
Yes. So before the pandemic, we were already seeing a rise in the rates of hunger and malnutrition. This started in 2015. When the pandemic started in 2020, it immediately triggered a hunger crisis in the whole world. So rich countries, poor countries alike, all of a sudden there was a spike in hunger. Now, when the pandemic then formally ended, what happened is the hunger crisis actually got worse. The reason is because there were temporary measures and social programs that were put in place during the pandemic to deal with a health crisis. This is things like universal school meals for children, sometimes throughout the whole year, not just the academic year, direct cash payments to people, supporting local food markets, local farmers markets. These programs were put in place as temporary measures to deal with the pandemic and the food crisis of the pandemic.
We have 30 seconds, Michael.
So what needs to be done is to turn those temporary programs into permanent programs. Otherwise, this global food crisis is only going to get worse.
Michael Fakhri is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food and a professor of law at the University of Oregon. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Sharif Abdelkaduz, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Taracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Osbeck, Emily Anderson, Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for Democracy Now!
This news is funded by viewers and listeners like you. Please support our work at democracynow.org/support.
Listen to music and podcasts from CGSF 90.1 FM with our radio app. It's on-the-go listening made easy. You can tune into all our music, spoken word, and multicultural shows using your device. Our app lets you set reminders so you'll never miss your favorite show again. Stay connected to CGSF 90.1 FM through our community radio app. Download the app from the Apple Store or get it on Google Play.